For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Priscilla Huff. U.S. President Barack Obama has blunt words for Donald Trump, telling the Republican presidential candidate to stop whining. Hillary Clinton is seen to have a solid lead in the presidential race, even in the so-called battleground states where the vote is closely divided. Donald Trump continues to insist there is widespread voter fraud. President Obama.
There is no serious person out there who would suggest somehow that you could even rig America's elections, in part because they're so decentralized. And the numbers of votes involved. There's no evidence that that has happened in the past or that there are instances in which that will happen this time. And so I'd advise Mr. Trump to stop whining and go try to make his case to get votes.
During a press conference in the Rose Garden with the Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, President Obama also said steady progress is being made in Mosul. But the European Union is warning its countries they should be prepared to see high numbers of extremists returning from Iraq and Syria. Our European correspondent Jack Perrick reports from Brussels.
It's believed over 2,500 people with European passports are still fighting with IS, and Sir Julian believes they could perform a mass exodus from Mosul if the terror group loses control of the city under the current assault by Iraqi government forces. The EU fears that those returning could carry out Paris or Brussels-style terror attacks, or that they could radicalize other people in Europe. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
The United Nations has said there will be no possibility of getting humanitarian aid into Syria after Russia made promises for an eight-hour ceasefire this week. Our UN correspondent Laura Kantikin reports.
The Russian and Syrian governments have made assurances to halt a bombing campaign in Aleppo in order for civilians to leave the besieged Syrian city. But Syria will still need to grant clearances for humanitarian deliveries in rebel-controlled eastern Aleppo. The UN says it will need to ensure that all parties have agreed to a ceasefire in order to safely move in aid. Laura Kantikin, New York.
A 72-hour ceasefire is set to take hold in Yemen following talks brokered by the United Nations. Our correspondent in New York, Lorna Shattuck, has an update.
The U.S. State Department has said the cessation should enable the U.N. Special Envoy to Yemen, Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed, to restart peace negotiations as soon as possible. And it's encouraged all parties to take the steps necessary to renew the cessation. It also added that the pause should allow humanitarian aid to be delivered to people across the country, where over 4,000 civilians have been killed and 3 million driven from their homes by the fighting. The war in Yemen began in 2014 when Shiite Houthi rebels based in the north seized the capital, Sana'a. Lorna Shattuck, New York.
A Russian Navy group led by the aircraft carrier Admiral Kuznetsov is set to sail through the English Channel. This is FSN.
Thank you, Priscilla Huff. Good stuff. Nice to hear from you. I hope you're well, by the way. It is Tuesday. I think it's October 18th, 2016. I've just checked, and indeed it is. My name is Richie Allen. Hope you've had a good Tuesday. Hope you've had a good old Tuesday. I think Claire Calvi, our producer, has put together a very interesting program for us over the next couple of hours. Thanks for joining us.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. The Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
Now, I look forward to reading your tweets. As always, tweet at Richie Allen Show. You can email richie@richieallen.co.uk. I prefer you tweet it, though. It's quicker and it's more reliable, easier for me to see them. Looking forward to our first guest, Kate Mullaney, or Mullaney, I think it might be Mullaney, joins us live from Ireland. Kate, along with her partner Marcus, they're pretty well known in Ireland for working with natural building, permaculture design, water purification and homeschooling. Now they're very interested in hemp juice and healing with hemp. That's their company, by the way, Healing with Hemp. They're going to talk to us about that, supplying it, what hemp juice is, how it can be beneficial for you, why we should pay more attention to that. Can't wait. Kate joins us this hour. And in the second hour, Catherine Austin Fitz joins the programme. She's the president of Solari Inc. She is a one-time managing director of Dillon Reed & Co. Bank on Wall Street and a former assistant secretary of housing under George Bush. She's going to be really interesting. Catherine Austin Fitz joins us in the second hour. As always, where possible, I'll put your questions and your points of view across. I look forward to doing that. Good stuff. I'm in good form today. Been a good old day. Been a busy day. Paul Ripley from Fab Radio 2 has been here today again, working on our brand new studio, which I'll be calling brand new probably for 6 or 8 months, putting together one or two finishing touches to it. So thanks to him for that. Busy old day. Alan Burton celebrates his birthday today. You might not know Alan. He's a listener to The Richie Allen Show and a supporter of the independent media. And I met Alan in Manchester over a year ago and I enjoyed meeting him. In fact, might have been under a year ago. So Alan, happy birthday to you. We're live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, as I mentioned, and alternatecurrentradio.com. Do check them out. And I have to mention, at the beginning of the programme, we had a very emotional conversation last night with Vanessa Bates, the mum of the conspiracy researcher and the very well-respected Max Spears, who died in very suspicious circumstances in Poland back in July in Warsaw. Now, Vanessa mentioned that she had flirted with the idea of a crowdfunding campaign to raise £1,000 for legal work, essential work to be done in Poland, to establish why Max wasn't given an autopsy in Poland, what happened there, the conduct of the police there, all of this. She needed £1,000. She was a bit sensitive, understandably, to some of the things that had been said to her on social media from one or two nasty people. And I suggested, well, get that funding, crowdfunding campaign up and running again. And I know that when people like David Icke and others share it, you'll get your £1,000 very quickly. Well, there's no need for it, at least not in the short term, because this morning, davidicke.com, David and Linda and Gareth and the small team and Jamie at davidicke.com sent a cheque for £1,000 to Vanessa Bates. Now, David is always insistent when he does things like this that they're not publicised. But I'm his mate and I say to hell with that. I'll publicise it because a lot of things are said about people like David Icke, not just David Icke, but others like him, about their motivation and their motivations for doing what they do. David Icke's a great guy. I've been lucky enough to know him now, personally, for nearly 4 years, and professionally, for nearly 8 years. Wonderful gesture from the folks at davidicke.com. And let me tell you, Vanessa Bates, wonderful woman, absolutely humbled by that gesture. She was thrilled by it. And I know that she's thanked David privately. What a lovely way to start the programme. Great stuff, delighted with that. Now, I was watching RT today. You might not know about Janice Atkinson. Who the hell is she, Rich? Well, Janice Atkinson is an independent MEP, member of the European Parliament. She was talking about her concerns that the operation to retake Mosul in Iraq will create even more displaced citizens. People. Now, the military advance by Iraqi and Kurdish forces began yesterday, and as you know, it's already led to heavy clashes. It's getting a lot of coverage in the news. The Red Cross also said they believe that up to 1 million refugees could be created, and they said this should be taken into account. Red Cross went as far as to say that maybe the attacks should be taken, shouldn't be taken lightly, and maybe they should be reconsidered because of the potential loss of life and displacement, as I said. Now, those wonderfully hypocritical Americans, don't you love the Yanks? Apologies to all our American listeners. Of course, I mean the administration. Those hypocrites said, no, that's wrong. We should encourage the advance on Mosul as the citizens there are in danger anyway. We shouldn't consider stopping the operation.
The idea that we, that somehow the Iraqi security forces should delay this operation because of their concern about the humanitarian situation in Mosul, that doesn't make sense.
White House press secretary. Funny, isn't it? They said Russia should stop bombarding Aleppo because of killing and displacing people, how quickly they change their minds when it suits them. Back to Janice Atkinson, MEP. She says she prays to God and Sonny Jesus that Donald Trump wins the election, because a Clinton victory would mean World War III.
Luckily, we're going to have a new president in the US in a few weeks' time. I hope to God it is Donald Trump rather than Hillary, because I can see us marching very forward to a third world war and actually nuclear warheads being deployed here. That's what frightens me. In the meantime, we have got this Middle East war. We're not going to win this until they all sit round the table and talk about it. We've got 300,000 Syrian migrants sitting in Germany at the moment that are going unprocessed. Yesterday, we took in hundreds of so-called migrant young boys without paperwork. You know, this report from Julian King is all very too little, too late, as I pointed out 2 months ago. The jihadis are already here. We've had hundreds return to our country. Some estimates say it's 1,000. We can't actually monitor the people that are here.
Janice Atkinson there. She mentioned Julian King. Julian King is the European Union Security Commissioner. Now, King said today that the European Union should be prepared for returning jihadists if the so-called Islamic State is driven out of Mosul. King told Germany's Die Welt newspaper, which means the world. I speak German. I don't really. I learned it at secondary level and I know a little bit. Die Welt is easy enough. You could have guessed that anyway. He told Die Welt that even a small number of militants would pose a serious threat and that we must prepare ourselves for this. Now, you'll know if you listen to this programme long enough, this has all been planned. Because it's easier to control you and me and divide us along the lines of fear and suspicion if you overwhelm our countries with desperate people. People fleeing the madness that our governments have created in the region. Collapsing vital public services in Britain, but also fostering hatred. Hatred for the refugees by people who don't know any better. And of course, hatred coming back from the refugees as they react to that in kind. It's all been planned for years. Researchers in this arena have been predicting this for years. And these are fascist times, my friend. We mentioned briefly yesterday at the top of the programme that NatWest, which is part UK government owned, it's a bank of course, it closed its RT television news accounts yesterday. Basically, NatWest closed RT's accounts in England. They gave no reasons, mind. I suppose they didn't have to give any reasons, really. It's as sinister as it gets. Terrifying it is, really. I'm not a fearmonger, as you know. RT provides an alternative point of view to the BBC and Sky in Britain. They give you a different explanation for the situation in Syria. They offer other solutions to the situation in Syria, situations that don't involve a no-fly zone and condemning people to death. This is not good. It's not good for the establishment in Britain. It gets in the way of the narrative being presented to the British people, so we must put a stop to it. And that's what they do. Now, film director Oliver Stone is in London. He's promoting a film, believe it or not. And he spoke to RT where he gave his opinion on what's going on.
RT has always been responsible, and they're very clear about their facts, it seems to me. And they show evidence, filmic evidence. So it's obviously, maybe you're a threat. They consider you propagandistic, but I wouldn't, when I read this London papers, I wonder who's propagandistic here. It seems that it's a media war, but it's really a shame that the truth has been sacrificed. The British people are not getting the news unless you allow other points of view. Al Jazeera, France 24 comes to mind, RT comes to mind. Listen to the news. If you're going to create enemies and say you have enemies, then you should know your enemy. I've always held to that principle. That's why I interviewed Castro, I interviewed Chavez. I'm interviewing Putin, going back to finish that documentary next year. So, no, it's important to know who you're talking to and have a respect for the multinational, the multipolar point of view.
couldn't do a lot more with the audio to make it any louder. Apologies there, but I guess you heard that. Interesting comments from Stone, and I would echo them. I would agree with him. What is it? 14 minutes past the hour. You might have heard in the news from Priscilla Huff there from DC at the top of the programme, you might have heard that US President Barack Obama has told Donald Trump to stop whining about the possibility that next month's White House election will be rigged. Can't happen, says Barack Obama. He's obviously not heard of Iowa in 2004, the Kerry-Bush election. Widespread voting irregularities there, Obama. You Muppet. Not to mention hundreds of thousands of your fellow African Americans being wrongfully struck off the voting rolls in Florida. Catherine Harris and good old boy Jeb Bush, they made sure of that, didn't they? No, it's all right, says Obama, nothing to see here. And then amazingly, Obama went on to say, although it wasn't mentioned in the news at the top of the hour, Obama actually said, now get your vomit bucket ready, that Donald Trump's flattery of Russian President Vladimir Putin is unprecedented. Holy Jesus. If I had time, I'd have dug out 1,000 clips of US presidents with their tongues stuck so far up Israeli Prime Minister's anuses that they were coming out of their mouths. Who writes this stuff for Obama? Does Obama not look at it and go, I can't say that. I can't say that Trump flattering Putin is unprecedented. I've just removed my tongue from Netanyahu's anus. Mother of Jesus. Moving on to Pamela Anderson. The great Pam. The actress, of course, and former playmate. She was on Channel 4 News last night. Now, I like Pamela Anderson. I've heard Pamela Anderson give a number of interviews on different subjects over the years. And rather like Melinda Messenger, another very well-known, very well-endowed, pretty woman in Britain. She's very clever, I think. Now, she was talking about porn addiction, was Pam, and the impact she feels it's having on society. Now, I'm very interested in this. Have a listen to Pamela Anderson on Channel 4 News on porn.
Well, I'm concerned about porn addiction, and I think it's infecting relationships. I think it's... I'm worried that the world's going to forget how to make love. I'm calling for a sensual revolution. I think the sexual revolution just gave us a lot of really bad sex. And I think it gave us a lot of freedom, but it also kind of is at a point now where it seems to be a dark turn. There's a lot of access. You know, I have two teenage boys, and I just want us to take stock of ourselves and kind of think about, just have a little bit of a timeout, press reset, how much of this is really affecting our lives. And you know, we're not talking about a dictatorship. We're not talking about government getting involved. Just about ourselves and just remembering what sensuality is and what intimacy is. And, you know, that's the best kind of sex, so...
But what is the dark turn? I mean, what is it that you think is happening to teenage boys and other people? You know, anyone who's consuming it.
Well, men, grown men too. You know, when you have a woman lying in bed in lingerie and you're in the bath, locked in the bathroom, looking at the computer, something's wrong. You know, so there's so much access, and I'm worried about that for young people too. That I know I should probably disqualify myself in this conversation because I'm a Playboy playmate. I had a tape stolen from my house and sold, you know, and all over the world that we had nothing to do with. But people need more and more to get aroused, I feel like, and I think it's leading towards violence against women, rape, child abuse. I really think it has something to do with that, and I think that we really have to start just thinking about what we're doing as people, how we're imprinting ourselves, what we're watching, what we're doing, what we're eating, what we're wearing. It all builds our character, and it's really important to just have the conversation.
I like Pamela Anderson. I think she's far, far brighter than she is portrayed in the media. And I agree with her. I believe that pornography isn't discussed enough on programmes like this because I've come to believe personally, and I discussed this many times with Caroline, the future Mrs. Allen, that porn and the constant usage of porn by children, young men, older men, is and has been encouraged by the mass media as another form or method of controlling us. I really believe that. And there are hundreds of studies on this, and they're not from Christian colleges or from far-right think tanks, but they're from neurologists, Ivy League universities. Not that it matters. Now, I know I said last night that old grimy David Robert Grimes and Oxford and all that, an Ivy League education doesn't make you brighter than the next guy. I'm mentioning that these studies on porn were conducted by Ivy League universities just to say that they were not carried out by religious-backed organisations. Anyway, so these studies, and I've been looking at several of them today, say that children who are exposed to a lot of porn become desensitised. Not just to porn, amazingly, but desensitised to violence and to conflict. And they become numb, effectively. Children lose empathy, right? The ability to feel things. Because porn targets the part of the brain that produces dopamine. A number of peer-reviewed studies are saying it. And just to sum up what these peer-reviewed studies are saying, and as I said, I've read several of them today to re-familiarise myself with it. Porn floods your brain with dopamine. But it overwhelms the brain. The levels of dopamine overwhelms the brain anyway. So it's like flooding. So what does the brain do? Well, it fights back by taking away some of its dopamine receptors. Now, I discovered through my research, dopamine receptors are like tiny ears on the end of a neuron that hear dopamine's message. So with the brain taking some of these away, with fewer of these receptors, these dopamine receptors, even if the brain is kind of putting off the same levels of dopamine in response to porn, what happens is the porn user can't feel the effect of dopamine as much. Because of that, the porn they were looking at doesn't seem as arousing or as exciting anymore. So they go hunting for more porn, more hardcore porn, to get the effect that they used to get. You get the picture, don't you? You get the picture. So the frequent porn user, their brain acclimatizes to the new levels of dopamine flooding through it. And you know what that does amazingly? Regular things, regular day-to-day activities that would normally give you a burst of dopamine, make you happy. Those things that you would do, like taking a walk, listening to the birds, walking your dog, walking on the beach by yourself, reading a book on the beach, those things are not strong enough to register anymore. So you get down, you get uneasy, you get fed up. You get fed up particularly when you go any distance or any time period without looking at porn. That's why it's so addictive. And once it gets you, the addiction, you have a whole new set of problems, because addiction damages the part of the brain that helps you think things through to make good choices. So addiction to porn affects your brain's limit-setting system and shrinks, believe it or not, your frontal lobes. And your frontal lobes, the part of the brain that controls logical problem-solving and decision-making. I wonder who would want to affect our brain's ability to solve problems and make decisions. Have a think about that. And I'll leave you, before I take a quick break, with this quote from Oscar Wilde, which I found interesting today. I've gone all poetic, I've gone all classy on the programme today. Wilde said, "Everything in the world is about sex except sex. Sex is about power." Back in a minute.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Do you want to release the full potential of your soul consciousness and find out how to experience that power in all areas of your life now? Go to livingasyoursoul.com for free guidance with in-depth how-to articles, free healing meditations of creation recordings, free soul solutions, and much, much more. livingasyoursoul.com, making the profound practical.
This is your Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com, broadcasting live on Alternate Current Radio, fabradiointernational.com and davidicke.com. Welcome to the show. 25 minutes past the hour. Back in a minute. Minutes past the hour, The Clash and Rock the Casbah on the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. Thanks for all the tweets, lovely tweets. I'll pass some of those on to all the gang at David Icke Books and davidicke.com for sending the £1,000 to Vanessa Bates this morning. A lot of love on Twitter and on Facebook for David. Thanks very much for that. Now, hemp juice. This is fascinating stuff and I'm very, very interested in it. Our next guest, along with her partner, is known throughout Ireland for their work with natural building, permaculture design, water purification and homeschooling, which we've talked a lot about on this programme. About 3 years ago, they turned their attention to hemp juice and Healing with Hemp was born. Now, of course, I'll tweet out details of their websites. They are leading suppliers internationally in the supply of hemp juice, and I want to find out more about it. So let's welcome to the programme Kate Mullany. Now, Kate, if it's Mullany, you can shoot me straight away. Is it Mullany or Mullany?
No, it's Mullany. You got it right the
Get
first time.
Get in there. So glad for that. There was a pub in Waterford years ago called Mullany's. So I went with that. Lovely to chat with you. Thanks for taking the call. How are you?
I'm very well. And thank you for having me on. I'm delighted.
Oh, it's good stuff, Kate. It's really good stuff. Listen, I'm not going to ask you about the big furore in Ireland at the moment about vaccines. I'm not going to do that, but I am very interested in one of the things that's going alongside this is there's a book coming out very soon by a doctor called Richard Rawlins, and a lot of scientists in Ireland are backing this book, and the book basically is all about alternative medicine and alternative healing. Now, Kate, you're not going to be surprised that the conclusion is that the best you can hope to get from alternative medicine is a placebo effect, and that people would be better spent appreciating the great work done by scientists and by the medicinal community and all of that old garbage. I don't suppose you'll be surprised to hear that. What do you reckon when you hear things like that?
Well, I'm not surprised for a start. I think if we were to measure the health of the planet by the number of hospitals, we'd be doing very well, but I don't really think that is the case.
No, me neither. No, it's a fascinating one. It's an ongoing thing we're having with various medical professionals in Ireland. But anyway, I want to leave that there. What a fascinating life you have, eh? Homeschooling, permaculture, we love that. Even the house that you built with Marcus, I believe, is absolutely fascinating. Do you want to tell us a little bit about yourselves before we talk about hemp juice?
Yeah, sure. Well, we got together 26 years ago. We've got three kids, all home-birthed and homeschooled. And we're terribly proud of how well they've done. They did all go to school for the final 3 years. So they did their state exams. They've never been vaccinated. And we've been building with hemp for whatever, 10 years now. The house is made of straw from roof to walls. And I don't know, what more can I say?
You're very modest, I think. You're very modest. I'm catching you on the hop with one or two of these questions, but that's good. I like that. Listen, before, because we're going to talk about healing with hemp, of course. That's why you're here. But I love what you said there about the three children. So they were home-birthed, homeschooled, didn't go to school until the final 3 years. So presumably when they were 13, 14, they went in. What has that done for them, do you think, Kate? How has that benefited them?
Well, actually, the eldest was 16 when he started school. And but what he actually came out of the school system with the second highest in the school of his Leaving Cert results. So we were terribly proud of that. And that was with 3 years in the school system. So that kind of doesn't say much for. I mean, we didn't sit down with them every day and teach them every day. We were more non-schoolers than homeschoolers, really. But the teachers in the school, all every parent-teacher meeting I had, they all were delighted to have the three kids in their classroom because they were interested. They asked interesting questions. They involved themselves with the teacher and actually generally kind of G'd up the whole classroom. So they were great kids to have in the classroom when they did eventually go in.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I have had parents on the program before, Kate, who are doing it now. And their children are, you know, they're pre-secondary school level children. And, you know, they talk about the ability that the freedom that your children have to be creative and to be playful and to explore and to find out things for themselves and how that benefits them and makes them better rounded and in fact better social people. They get on with people better. Do you notice that?
Oh yeah, for sure. And people always said to me, you know, when I would say that they were homeschooled, oh, what about the social education that they're missing out on? But I mean, I do think that children, human beings generally actually aren't really supposed to be in a room with 30 other people of the same age group. It doesn't suit them. So children in particular, there's too much competition in an arena like that. And our kids grew up with, from their grandparents up the road to various woofers. I don't know if you're familiar with that organization, willing workers coming in to help, you know, of all age groups, of all nationalities. Even though we live in very rural Monaghan, the kids have had exposure to many, many different kids, you know, from around the world.
Fantastic. You know, I might invite you back on in the future to talk about that and the experience, because I'm sure you had roadblocks. I'm sure there were people who didn't want you to do it. And it would be interesting to get that story sometime. Yeah. So, Kate, what is, for the uninitiated, we can't assume knowledge. We often do it and it's wrong. What is hemp juice exactly? What is it?
Well, simply, it's the juice from the hemp plant. So we grow industrial hemp. And it's simply the juice expressed from that plant.
Simple as that. And and the extraction process presumably is reasonably straightforward.
Yeah, we have special twin gear slow juicer. So it's a slow extraction, cold pressed hemp juice. It's nearest model, I guess. Its nearest equivalent juice would be wheatgrass. It's similar.
Right.
It certainly looks similar. It's different, but it looks similar.
Now, I suppose getting interested in it was a natural progression for you. But what was it that drew you to it? Had you experience with it? Did you have reason to need to use it? How did you get interested in it, you and Marcus?
Well, in the plant itself.
Yeah, in the plant, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I suppose because we came from the permaculture background and we were pioneers in the building, alternative building industry in the country, in Ireland. And we tried loads of different things, actually, and we built our own house of straw bales. And when we found out, I mean, I think we were maybe first in the country, close to first in the country to be building with hemp. In fact, I think our office is the first hemp building in the country. That was what convinced us that we could grow this plant in Ireland and process it ourselves and just have a fantastic building material on our doorstep.
And there's no issues with growing hemp, right? None?
No, not at all. No, certainly we've never had any issue. We just apply for the license and we keep getting it renewed every year. And no, there is no problem. There's criteria you have to meet, but they're not problematic.
Yeah, asking that because some of our listeners, of course, people, and you know this yourself, people equate it with the cannabis plant, don't they? And they mix it up and they equate it and they wonder about the legality of it and all of that. Now, juicing it, what does it do, Kate? I know it's your website is great, by the way. It's healing-with-hemp.com, and I'm going to tweet it out there so people can get on there. And you do list all the properties of it. It's very good stuff. Tell us what it does.
God. Well, if you just take the plant, the juice as itself, a green juice, it's full of essential minerals and vitamins. It's absolutely fantastic. Just from that, from its own right, just in a mineral and vitamin standpoint. But I guess the real interesting thing about the juice is actually the CBD content. And CBD, I'm sure most of your listeners will know that CBD is cannabidiol. And that is, I suppose in the words of Dr. William Courtney, he calls it an essential dietary supplement. CBD is an essential dietary supplement. So it's as important to us as, calcium, potassium, zinc, mineral, all those, it's equally important to our bodily functioning as all the known minerals and vitamins.
And it has had, and there are questions coming in, I'm going to get to them shortly now. It's at Richie Allen Show on Twitter, and I've just tweeted the website out there. It has, people make claims about it, don't they? That it's very good for helping overcome various illnesses and ailments. Do you want to talk about that?
Yes. It's all about the claims, I guess, at the end. Yes, it is. It feeds the endocannabinoid system. It's hard not to get too kind of technical with this subject because I don't know really how else to explain it except through these kind of big, long words. But the endocannabinoid system it's like our vascular system. It runs through our body. It's the part of our, its function is to, in the call and response, the pain and the how to deal with that pain, messaging system. So if we burn our finger, the message is take your finger away from the flame. And then the response is, you got burnt and a little bit of swelling. And, that's where the endocannabinoid system comes in. In that message, call and response.
I think, Kate, it's fair to say, forget about me trying to play the devil's advocate and say that some people say that it's placebo and all of that nonsense. The fact is, people who've used it for chronic pain for years, the consensus among them, and I won't say it's 100%, but it's probably upwards of 90% anyway, in anecdotes, that I've read and reports I've read, they say it has a significant effect on chronic pain, right?
Yeah, it does. And it has the ability to rebuild bone and reduce swelling. And there's numerous benefits to it. But regarding the pain, I think that's all to do with the reduction of swelling. I think that's where that comes in. I mean, I'm not sure. I mean, Richie, we're coming from a farming background.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah, and we're having to do, I mean, it's great and it's really exciting work, having to learn all about medical treatments and medical injuries. And, it's a huge learning curve for us. Whilst I am enjoying it, it's a massive body of work. Even just understanding and knowing about CBD is a huge amount of work.
And but there's sorry to interrupt there, Kate. Is a lot of your time, well, not a lot of it, but a significant amount of it taken up with, you know, being very careful? Because I like your website a lot. It's very, very professional. And yeah. There are no outlandish claims made on there, even though some of those claims made on other websites might very well be true. And I suspect maybe some of them are true. But on your website, it's a credit to you. It isn't. Do you spend, you and Marcus, a lot of time thinking about what you say and how you say it?
Yeah, and we have had to. I think chiefly because we're selling hemp juice as a food, or we're marketing it as a food. It's very much a food. And we can't make any claims about CBD as a food because it's never had the food trials done. Not yet. So our labelling, the FSAI, the Food Safety Authority of Ireland, have been on me from the beginning to be sure I was not making any claims. So yeah, we have had to consciously try to work around how to say CBD without saying CBD. And in the way we've done that is really by selling it as a food. It's simply an essential food, food that we need for our body, that's, you know, it's so valuable for our well-being. Actually, that's almost unbelievable.
Yeah, and again, I'm loving having you on talking about this. We've had people talking about this kind of generally and informally around other subjects on the programme before. I'm fascinated by it, I really am. Look, I'm going to say this. I don't, and this is just an opinion, I have to say, you know, to take your lead, Kate, and to be fair and to be objective, I can't say this for a fact, it's just an opinion. If, of course, CBD has the remarkable effect on chronic pain and maybe other things that we believe it does, well, there's going to be pressure from those who make products that we buy over the counter and some that we don't buy over the counter to help with pain management, anti-inflammatories and codeine and stuff like that. Well, I'm supposed, I'm going around the bushes saying, Kate, I wouldn't be holding my breath waiting for somebody to do proper clinical trials on this wonderful, let's be honest about it, it's a wonderful, wonderful natural thing.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree entirely. Although I have made inquiries about making food trials. Okay, if we had 50,000 euros to spare, we might begin to start some trials. But it isn't impossible. And there is a lot of evidence already out there, scientific evidence about CBD and about, you know, how it's used in the dietary, you know, arena. So it's not untenable for us to actually pull something together. And we are trying to do something like that. Maybe someday.
Maybe someday. Now, some of our listeners are fascinated by this. If anybody wants to go on Twitter, go to twitter.com, put Richie Allen Show, all one word, no spaces in, and you'll see what everybody else is tweeting. Huge interest in this. You'll know, Kate, you will know, I guess, or you might know, that for a long time, medical cannabis activists have been trying to get the therapeutic benefits of cannabis recognised in the UK. But you'll also know that the MHRA, which is the Medicines Healthcare Products and Regulatory Agency in the UK, has decided to reclassify CBD, the compound found in cannabis even, and that there are worries that this is going to force it underground more than ever. They want to reclassify it. Have you been following that, and what do you make of it?
Yeah, I have been following it. What do I make of it? Well, I think you can look at it from two sides of the fence, really. One is that we know the value of this food, and it's hard not to shout out about it. And it's very important that food be, our food, our medicine, be recognised for sure. And then there's the other side of the fence, that there is a need for some legislation or control. I don't really know what the proper word is, but, you know, so responsibility of the manufacturers to be clear about what it is that they're making, and that you know what you're buying when you buy your CBD oil, that you have a recall.
Right. So you kind of understand why they're doing it, but at the same time, there's concern there because those who are worried about it, they're saying that, well, Peter Reynolds, for example, and he's with Clear Cannabis Law Reform. He said it means CBD has become subject to medicines regulation as it applies in the UK, which means either it has to have a marketing authorization, which is the new word for a license, or a traditional herbal registration. Now, that worries people because why should anybody need a license, you know, to use something like this, which is natural, which is pure? And I understand that side of it as well. In fact, I'd have a lot of sympathy with that point of view, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely, totally. I agree entirely. I suppose because it's been out there as a new product, and there has been, I mean, it's the unsubstantiated claims, I suppose, that they're worried about. Yeah, of course, it's a great medicine, but let's get some real support behind that from the industry itself. I mean, I'm not talking about Big Pharma. I'm talking about us, the people who are producing the CBD, you know, that it's our responsibility to
get clinical trials on it effectively, to bring it into the public domain in that way, maybe. No, is that not a possibility?
Yeah, to do that. Yeah, exactly. I think there is a cost, and I'm sure it's a lot of money, but I know there is a lot of money to be made from this CBD. You know, it's valuable. And I think it's the responsible way to go to make it clear.
Tell us, Kate. I think we heard Marcus in the background there. Marcus, welcome. If you're there, nice to be chatting to you tonight. And
try not to interfere too much.
Oh, interfere? No, it's great. It's lovely. I love when I hear that. A bit of prompting going on in the background. I get a lot of prompting, but you can't hear it, you see. I sound like I'm clever, but I'm not really. I have people prompting me. How did you know that? Somebody's telling me in the background. your lifestyle looks like, I won't say it seems, it's amazing. The way you live and what you're doing. And a number of people have already tweeted us. And my producer, Claire, who's been in touch with you, obviously said that, you know, the life that you're leading is idyllic. So I'm bound to ask this. I can't not ask it. Do you ever worry about any attempt by those, I don't want to get too conspiratorial now, but those in power? I believe that there are people who don't want us to live off grid. Just to sum it up there without going around the bushes again. Do you ever worry about that, Marcus? You know, that there are people who don't want us to live this natural, wonderful, sustainable. Because it sounds to me that you guys are living sustainably. You're not taking from the earth what you don't put back into it. You're living this wonderful lifestyle. But yet there are people who don't like that. What do you think of that, Marcus?
Yeah, well, I mean, they can't really do an awful lot about it in a sense. Each one of us has to at least have a go, you know, at making living as lightly as possible as we can on the earth. And that was kind of like our vision of whatever it was 20 years ago or 25 years ago. I remember we did our first permaculture course, and it was just like so inspiring, you know, to say, oh, this is the way we can create on this planet a real paradise, all of us collectively, by working with the land, even if it's only a tiny garden. So, you know, it's about what we do on a day-to-day basis, the little choices, you know. And if it's doing fun things then as well, like building with straw or wood or mud, or just looking what's there, looking what's around us, that's what's all right. And that's fun, you know. But I don't really worry too much about Big Brother. I mean, Big Brother has kind of given me a bit of a knock already. But, you know, it's not something that you pick yourself up and you go on. And keep going. And we're all in that situation, every one of us, that kind of like shadow of fear, oh God, we can't do this, we can't live our dream. But actually, we can, and the more of us that do, the easier it'll get.
I can imagine when you started, both of you, Kate, you must have been a real source of fascination to your family and your friends. I suppose you got all the jokes about the good life, didn't you, and all of that, the old BBC programme. I guess there were people who thought it was quite strange. But I suppose they have a different opinion now, Kate. It looks wonderful, you know, the life, what you're doing with the company. I'm sure people changed their minds over the years.
God. Well, they have accepted for sure. Certainly our neighbours and our friends and our neighbours have completely accepted what we're doing. And maybe you're right. Maybe the our families were the most objectionary about what we were doing. But certainly they're absolutely without a question of a doubt the most supportive now. No questions asked. I mean, just the number of people who visited and asked to visit. I'm not shouting out or boasting or anything, but I do think we've genuinely influenced hundreds of people down through the years, getting them started on their own little organic garden, getting them, the idea of maybe building something for themselves. Well, we're not actually off-grid, but, you know, that idea certainly...
Yeah, we kind of compromised along the way. We kind of struggled a little bit because... it's actually quite difficult to live simply in the current modern world, and it's quite simple to have a very complicated life. It's the easiest way to get in, you know. So we're kind of like out of time a little bit, and we don't have the broader, like one of the a really good permaculture designer. I remember seeing it at the very beginning, and Bill Mollison was very shrewd, and he put it in all the different elements that we have of our gardens, our orchards, and our houses and our building materials. But there was this, the one little box, the financial structures and the money system and the technologies and all this stuff that we don't have access to. That we don't have access to, like the capital that's we're all actually all our capital is disappearing off up into the big pyramid all the time. So there's a like break on the whole society all the time, sucking us in the wrong direction. And how to switch out of that, how we as human beings gradually move away from the chaos world into the organic world. It's going to be a slow thing, but and I think that was kind of our purpose now, is kind of like open that space a little bit and try and encourage other people to come in the same direction.
There's a huge amount of interest in this on our Twitter. You should go and have a look later on. Go to our Twitter page and just put our show name, all one word, in. Press enter and you'll see what people are saying. A lot of interest in it. A lot of people really happy to hear it. So where, I mean, I've already tweeted out the website. I'm going to say it again. It's all the W's, www.healing-with-hemp.com. That's where you'll find out all about Marcus and Kate. So people can buy it direct from you. And do you ship overseas or is it just in Ireland? You do ship overseas.
Well, we have.
Of course you do.
Well, just over the Irish Sea, actually.
Over the Irish Sea, right. You ship to here, right? You ship to the UK, good.
There are some benefits to living on the border, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So our nearest post office in Northern Ireland is just 3 miles away. So we can nip across, get guaranteed next day delivery in both UK and Ireland. So, yes, we have the two islands covered. After that, we're working on it a little bit.
Yeah, we're bringing out little freeze-dried capsules as well, and we'll be able to post them internationally in a couple of months. So that's kind of coming down the line.
Yeah.
Well, it's wonderful. I'd love to get you back on sometime to talk about. I mean, my listeners are probably annoyed that I haven't asked you more about why you chose not to vaccinate the three boys. So I'll tell you what, in 60 seconds, why did you choose not to vaccinate the three children?
Because the risk was far too great. My God, I read a lot about vaccinations and I just thought, no way, there isn't enough evidence to support this. And besides, my own mother had, children my age, my own mother knew 5 different families who were affected by vaccination, or that was what they said at the time, that they were directly affected after, the children were directly affected after they'd had vaccination. So it was just a no-brainer as far as I was concerned. No way. Absolutely not.
Yeah, we've decided in the event that, you know, I mean, we want to have children, Caroline and I, we've decided not to to vaccinate. I'm fascinated by that. Thanks to the both of you for coming on. I think your business is brilliant. I also want to say, by the way, and I shouldn't do this, I shouldn't editorialise like this, but I've been looking around the shop on your website, and I think your pricing is great. I think it's very affordable, and I like that. You know, I really do.
I'm delighted you said that, because actually, if from gram for gram or milligram for milligram, the juice is
10 times cheaper than the other CBD
than oil. So I mean, yeah, I just toot my own horn there.
I was in Clonus the other day, and I was talking to a young lassie, and she was drinking a Diet Coke, and I said, "Listen, that Diet Coke cost you a euro. The same euro would buy a cube of our hemp juice. You know, you really need to think about what we're actually putting into our bodies. Yeah. Little minor and buying choices that we make every day. We want to feed ourselves, and hemp juice is here, and we've made it as available as possible. We want it. We're selling it as a food, you know, and it's good stuff, and people can get us into them."
Hey, listen, I really enjoyed talking to both of you. Thanks for coming on the programme.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having us.
Anytime. Stay in touch. That was lovely. Kate Mullany there on the line to us from Monaghan, and you heard towards the end of it there, Marcus McCabe, her partner. Wonderful stuff. And you heard them on Tuesday's edition of The Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. Tell you what I'll do. Quick break, back in a minute.
Do you want to release the full potential of your soul consciousness and find out how to experience that power in all areas of your life now? Go to livingasyoursoul.com for free guidance with in-depth how-to articles, free healing meditations of creation recordings, free soul solutions, and much, much more. Livingasyoursoul.com, making the profound practical.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk. Now.
Yeah, fascinating people, eh? Kate Mullany. Had to say that right, didn't I? I'm glad I got that right. Kate Mullany in Monaghan and Marcus McCabe, healing-with-hemp.com. I've tweeted out the website already. What is it? 4 minutes to the top of the hour. Thanks for staying with the programme. Love that you do. I really appreciate it. I've not done this for a while, but I'm going to do it now. Folks, the programme does need your support. It really does. Your financial support. It doesn't have to be much, but please go to richieallen.co.uk. There are PayPal and bank account details there, or just go to paypal.me/Richie Allen, paypal.me/Richie Allen, and do make a contribution to our programme if you possibly can. It's your show, remember, and thanks again to those of you who do that, and to those of you who cannot afford to do that, as I said before, and I mean it, do not give it a second thought. Your presence is good enough for me. Right, that's it for the first hour of the programme. Going to take news at the top of the hour from DC. Then we're going to be chatting with Catherine Austin Fitz. Fascinating woman. I think you're going to like her. It's going to be a busy hour next hour, so stay tuned for that. News is next after this from Def Leppard. In a kind of a hard rock kind of mood today. We listen to a lot of hard rock. AlternateCurrentRadio.com, Fab Radio 2, David Icke. .com and my own website. This is your Richie Allen Show. I'll see you after the news.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Priscilla Huff. U.S. President Barack Obama has blunt words for Donald Trump, telling the Republican presidential candidate to stop whining. Hillary Clinton is seen to have a solid lead in the presidential race, even in the so-called battleground states where the vote is closely divided. Donald Trump continues to insist there is widespread voter fraud. President Obama.
There is no serious person out there who would suggest somehow that you could even rig America's elections, in part because they're so decentralized and the numbers of votes involved. There's no evidence that that has happened in the past or that there are instances in which that will happen this time. And so I'd advise Mr. Trump to stop whining and go try to make his case to get votes.
During a press conference in the Rose Garden with the Italian Prime Minister Matteo Renzi, President Obama also said steady progress is being made in Mosul. But the European Union is warning its countries they should be prepared to see high numbers of extremists returning from Iraq and Syria. Our European correspondent Jack Perrick reports from Brussels.
It's believed over 2,500 people with European passports are still fighting with IS, and Sir Julian believes they could perform a mass exodus from Mosul if the terror group loses control of the city under the current assault by Iraqi government forces. The EU fears that those returning could carry out Paris or Brussels-style terror attacks, or that they could radicalize other people in Europe. Jack Perrick, Brussels.
The United Nations has said there will be no possibility of getting humanitarian aid into Syria after Russia made promises for an eight-hour ceasefire this week. Our UN correspondent Laura Kantikin reports.
The Russian and Syrian governments have made assurances to halt a bombing campaign in Aleppo in order for civilians to leave the besieged Syrian city. But Syria will still need to grant clearances for humanitarian deliveries in rebel-controlled eastern Aleppo. The UN says it will need to ensure that all parties have agreed to a ceasefire in order to safely move in aid. Laura Kantikin, New York.
A 72-hour ceasefire is set to take hold in Yemen following talks brokered by the United Nations. Our correspondent in New York, Lorna Shattuck, has an update.
The U.S. State Department has said the cessation should enable the U.N. Special Envoy to Yemen, Ismail Ould Sheikh Ahmed, to restart peace negotiations as soon as possible. And it's encouraged all parties to take the steps necessary to renew the cessation. It also added that the pause should allow humanitarian aid to be delivered to people across the country, where over 4,000 civilians have been killed and 3 million driven from their homes by the fighting. The war in Yemen began in 2014 when Shiite Houthi rebels based in the north seized the capital, Sana'a. Lorna Shattuck, New York.
A Russian Navy group led by the aircraft carrier Admiral Kuznetsov is set to sail through the English Channel. This is FSN.
Thank you, Priscilla Huff. Good stuff there. Welcome back to the program, Tuesday, October 18th this year. You know it's 2016. Broadcasting live on Alternate Current Radio. Check out alternatecurrentradio.com, the terrific chat room there. We are on the TuneIn app. We're on Fab Radio 2 in Manchester. We're everywhere. There's no escaping from us. Really enjoyed the first hour there. If you just came in on the end of it, don't forget the program is repeated on a loop from 11 p.m. BST every night, but it's also podcasted straight after the old show. I never stop working, me. Never stop working. Lots to get through between now and the end of the show. A lot of you excited about Catherine Austin Fitz. She joins us in a few minutes' time. And already the tweets are coming in for her. We're going to talk finance. We're going to talk a lot more besides finance, though. Believe you me. Back in a minute.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is the Richie Allen Show in association with DavidIke.com.
Do you want to release the full potential of your soul consciousness and find out how to experience that power in all areas of your life now? Go to livingasyoursoul.com for free guidance with in-depth how-to articles, free healing meditations of creation recordings, free soul solutions, and much, much more. livingasyoursoul.com, making the profound practical.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Welcome back to the show. Right, it is what? It's 5 minutes past the hour. Our next guest is standing by in Tennessee. The joys of modern technology. It's made the world a very small place. Remember, you can tweet our show at any time. It's at Richie Allen Show. You can email Richie at richieallen.co.uk. Catherine Austin Fitz joins us in a couple of minutes' time to take us there. This is David Bowie. And it's on your Richie Allen Show, Europe's most listened to independent radio show. That's a fact as well. DavidIke.com, Fab Radio 2, Alternate Current Radio. Always great to be with you. Tuesday, second hour. Stay with me. Keep the tweets and the emails coming in. Catherine Austin Fitz is after Young Americans from David Bowie.
They pulled in just behind the bridge. He lays her down. He frowns. Gee, my life's a funny thing. Am I still too young? He kissed the venom there. She took his ring. Took his babies. It took him minutes. Took her nowhere. Heaven knows he'd have taken in a thing.
All night.
She wants a young.
I was lucky enough to see him live a couple of times, David Bowie and Young Americans on your Richie Allen Show. The time is 7.5 minutes past the hour. Let's welcome our next guest to the show. We're very excited that she's agreed to come on the programme. Now, all 7 billion of us, or 7.1 or 2 billion, whatever the figure is, the global population, we are in an invisible debt prison. No doubt about it. We collectively owe, between us, private central banks over $90 trillion, give or take a couple of dimes or a couple of pennies. Now, some independent economists have come on this programme and have told us that it is mathematically impossible to ever repay such a figure. Through our work, all of our collective work, we don't create enough money. That's everybody on the planet. We don't create enough money to even service the debt. So who benefits from that? Well, people are starting to ask questions, finally. Although not enough people, but some people in Greece, in Ireland and in Spain, to name three countries, they're asking questions about money. Now, my next guest is a former managing director of Wall Street Bank Dylan Reed & Co., and she was Assistant Secretary of Housing and Federal Housing in the first Bush administration. She is currently the president of Solari Inc., the publisher of the Solari Report, and the managing member of Solari Investment Advisory Services. It's a pleasure to welcome Catherine Austin Fitz to the programme. Catherine, lovely to have you on. How are you?
Richie, great. It's great to be on.
Well, thanks for doing it. Fascinating, Catherine, because I've known about you for some time. And I love what you do. And I've heard you being interviewed on various commercial stations in the United States. And I always love listening to what you have to say. So it's about time you came on our programme. Catherine, something you recently said fascinated me and disturbed me in equal measures. Now, I think you said, and I paraphrase what you said, and you can beat me up if I get this wrong, but you said that people have saved their money for decades, the baby boomers, and they've trusted the system, the banks and the building societies, to manage their savings and investments for their retirement years, but that this money has been squandered on secret government classified programs like space projects, weapons, underground bases, to name a few. And if you said that, I agree with it, if that's what you said. So I'll ask you this, Catherine. Is that what manipulated crashes are all about? Partly all about? To cover this sort of behaviour, to cover it up. What do you think?
Well, we've seen cycles and what I would call pump and dumps or selective crashes regularly harvest the population. But Richie, something started in the mid-90s, which I think is more extraordinary than the normal sort of harvesting. And I call it the financial coup d'etat, which is the shift of enormous amount of assets out of governmental and community hands, and a shifting of liabilities back into government. And that swap, you know, the private parties getting the assets and the governmental structures of the pension funds getting the liabilities. Again, I call it a coup d'etat. And I think what happened, a decision was literally made to shift the equivalent of the G7 retirement savings out for private purposes. And it could have gone for a variety of purposes, and we can talk about that. But think of this as privatization at the root. You know, it's privatization on the just do it method. We take all the money and leave the liabilities in government. And then when it's all over, we turn to you and the taxpayers and say, well, you know, there's no money here.
And the taxpayers, people like you and me, not like you and me, because we've been lucky enough to discover, I've discovered it through people like you, but we know it. But the taxpayers are completely oblivious, Catherine, right? They haven't a clue what's going on.
Well, I think that they know something is terribly wrong. So particularly with the bailouts, if you look at the bailouts in the United States, Richie, they were three times what was necessary to pay off all the residential mortgages in the country. So you're talking about money in a size sufficient, so the official explanations don't add up and they don't make any sense. I'll give you another example. We've seen money going missing from the U.S. Department of Defense and housing and other government agencies since the fiscal 1998. But last year, for example, the Department of Defense was missing over $9 trillion, and that's many multiples of the entire federal budget. So now, can you lose that much money in a year? Yes, if you engage in securities fraud. So you can, in fact, steal many multiples of the federal budget in 1 year. But you know, we're looking at a level of fraud which is systemic. So let me give you an example. In 2000, I went to visit with the chief of staff to the senator who was the chair of the Appropriations Committee that oversaw the Department of Housing and Urban Development, where I used to serve as Assistant Secretary of Housing. And I was in litigation with the federal government. I was trying to get my company paid. And I said to the chief of staff, to the senator, and that senator who runs that appropriation committee is arguably, after the president, the most powerful person overseeing appropriations in that particular area. So I said, the chief of staff looked at me and said, what do you think is going on at the Department of Housing and Urban Development, which runs a massive mortgage insurance portfolio? And I said, I don't know. What do you think is going on? And they looked me dead in the eye and they said, HUD is being run as a criminal enterprise.
Wow.
And I said to them, I don't disagree. Now, here's what you need to know. That department is run by the Department of Justice, the Department of the Treasury, the big New York Fed member banks that act as depository for the U.S. government, and the big defense contractors who run the information and payment systems. And so if that agency is being run as a criminal enterprise, it cannot be run as a criminal enterprise without all of those institutions being complicit. They have to consciously intentionally, knowledgeably run it as a criminal enterprise, which I believe they are.
There's no, Catherine, there's no plausible deniability here. They have to know, and they have to be taking part in it.
Well, they have to implement. So let me give you another. I find stories very helpful to this. In 1994-95, my company was working as the lead financial advisor for the Federal Housing Administration at the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And because of that, I was privy to their plan, their strategic plan, and they were planning to dramatically increase originations of mortgage insurance in the poor, particularly African-American neighborhoods. And at the same time, they were working on dramatically increasing the number of arrests in those neighborhoods and growing private prisons. And at that very time, I also saw their affordable housing targets for Freddie and Fannie, the government-sponsored enterprises, and they were requiring that Freddie and Fannie dramatically increase their originations in those same neighborhoods. And I saw the numbers. I was shocked, and I looked at the controller of FHA, and I said, wait a minute. You can't make these numbers. You're talking about more, you know, more mortgages than there are homes or people in those neighborhoods. People are going to have to refinance their mortgages twice a year from prison. And they looked at me and they said, shut up. This is none of your business. So they knew. They knew they were planning on levels of originations that were fraudulent.
My God.
It was a plan. If you look at the changes in the law at Freddie, Fannie, VA, FHA, Treasury, the Department of Justice, you're talking about very complex changes throughout all the different bureaucracies, because the federal credit stands behind 80% or more of the single family and even more of the multifamily insurance in the United States. So if you're going to have a housing bubble, it's very takes a lot of work by the central bank and the Treasury and federal agencies to engineer it. And so this was very, very engineered, which is why it's always funny to see the Department of Justice charging fees, you know, to banks for engaging in this, because it, in fact, the Department of Justice was one of the greatest leaders of making it happen.
Let me ask you this. This comes up on the show, and it drives me mad. We're led to believe, those of us that work, you know, in programs or on programs like this, journalists, that 15 million properties have been taken back by these banks in the United States, and I understand that to be correct. And those properties have been sold to hedge funds on the cheap. What's going to happen with those properties, first and foremost, Catherine? And second of all, that had to be the plan all along. That's what you were saying to me. Yeah. And I believe
the plan, the plan, first of all, the plan was to, so for example, in the beginning of the Clinton administration, the head of that group at the Department of Housing and Urban Development said, look, black people are hopeless. We're going to move them out and bring in the Hispanics. So there was a plan to gentrify these neighborhoods and swap the population. And that was part of rounding up basically over a million people and putting them in prison. And so you had a social engineering. But the other thing you were trying to do was pump up the economy while you shifted a huge amount of money out in the financial coup d'etat. You didn't want anybody to notice. And the way they didn't know, they were too busy having a housing bubble to notice. But the final thing you wanted to do is, coming into the changes in technology, you wanted much, much greater ownership of land and control of different places so you could re-engineer. Now, they've been stockpiling a lot of the housing in these basically pools and using them as rental housing, or just re-engineering. If you go into a place like Detroit, that you're talking about a radical re-engineering of sort of how the whole place works and the governance system. Now, I can guess at the end game, but it's only a guess. But needless to say, you were taking central control of places in a way that made you an enormous amount of money and gave you much more power in each place. Remember, the way the U.S. economy is controlled politically is it's controlled bottom up. We have 3,100 counties, and you want to control the cash flows in each county, one of the ways that you took over the counties politically was with drug money and illegal money, including the mortgage fraud. But you use that money to then buy up political control, and that gives you the control you need bottom up to then control the states and the federal government. And that's the, you know, the prize, controlling the global currency and the federal credit then gives you control of the most powerful financial engine ever created. And part of our challenge globally is, you know, it's a runaway train now and nobody knows how to stop it without a giant crash.
We are going to talk about the end game, and I know that you believe, and it's such a boon, that's an old-fashioned word now, such a boon for programs like this to have somebody like you who's worked right in the heart of the establishment to have the courage to say what you really think, knowing that it might have consequences for you. I'm really, really impressed by that when it happens, because it doesn't happen often enough. We've got Catherine Austin Fitz on the show. Go to Solari.com. That's the website. We'll tweet it out there now to find out more about her and what they do at Solari.com as well, which is very interesting. And we're talking about the housing bubble, the manufactured crashes previously, where it's all going to end up. So, Catherine, they're taking power away from people by creating a whole generation of renters. And if you have a whole generation of renters, you have a whole generation of people that it's very easy to control. Because if you factor into that the onrush of the cashless society, the digital currency society where everything will be on card or will pay by your phone, you're going to have the ability to switch somebody off, Catherine, to kill them effectively in a matter of seconds, right?
Well, yeah. So what we're watching is a real movement to end individual sovereignty of all kinds.
Right.
And part of it is you get people to stop being landowners and homeowners, and you stop them from getting to be principals who own business, their own business, and are building family wealth by building equity. So how does family wealth develop? It develops by owning your own home, building land, building farms, building businesses. And so part of what you're watching is an effort to strip that away. And the financial system is really being used to engineer a harvesting and a shifting of that equity into corporate equity. And we can talk more about that, because part of the opportunity, of course, is to re-engineer it out of the centralized systems back into small farms and small businesses that really build very powerful equity for us. The second part of this, though, is using invasive technology, even if we do own our own home or our own business, using invasive technology to basically harvest our equity through the intelligence and systems. So we're engaged in a kind of surveillance capitalism, if you will, and between the intelligence that they're able to access, often technically illegally, but also the entrainment and mind control technology they're using on these vehicles, you're watching a compromising of an individual at the deepest level. And of course, now we see, you know, everyone from NBC to Dr. Oz now trying to promote us to microchip our children and microchip ourselves. And then you're talking about the complete compromise, which is going not even to a step of slavery, but a step of, I would say, livestock. So we're really coming into the end game, which is not about money. You know, for them, money's simply a way of managing and a control system. We're talking about, are we going to be a human civilization, or are we going to be an inhuman civilization?
The transhumanist agenda going side by side with this, as you've just touched on there, it's massive, Catherine, and anybody who consumes media the way that producers of talk shows like this do. I mean, we consume a lot of media in order to see what they're saying and what they're doing, in order to critique it. The agenda, that agenda is being pushed like never before through TV programming, through TV dramas, as you said, through real-life programs like Dr. Phil and all of that. It's absolutely terrifying. And what I can see here is that the generation, I'm 41 years old now, so two generations before me, the teenagers, those that group of people, they're embracing this with both hands, right? They think this is brilliant.
Well, in my experience, many seem to, but not all do. And it's the same with, I see it in all generations. You have, you know, let me jump back. When I was Assistant Secretary of Housing, I worked in a federal agency. There was a cabinet secretary and maybe about 38 political appointees. And we had a very, the cabinet secretary happened to be emotionally very unstable, and he used to have occasional psychotic episodes, at which point he would propose, and most 27 of the political appointees would follow along and agree with him. And then there were three of us who just seemed to never lose our minds. I don't know what it was, but we seemed to be immune to the whole process.
Right.
And we stayed fairly grounded. And I see the same thing in all generations that I'm dealing with. You have a certain number of people who realize pretty one way or another that the official reality is simply a fiction. And, you know, learn to navigate a world where there's a big difference between the official reality and reality. And although they all would describe it differently, they seem to find their divine purpose. And they don't want to resonate with the machine. They'd rather resonate with the bees or the trees or, you know, whatever they call their spiritual intelligence. And they seem to be able to hold the line against the seduction of the machine.
So much interest in this, unsurprisingly, on social media. If you're just joining the show, the former managing director of Wall Street Bank, Dylan Reed & Co., and also Assistant Secretary of Housing and Federal Housing in the first Bush administration, it's Catherine Austin Fitz on the line. Go to Solari.com. That's where the Solari report is published. It's really, really interesting stuff. So just briefly then, Catherine, on crashes and on bringing down the financial system and Deutsche Bank and all of that. Go back to where we started this. Go back to the very beginning when I said to you, there is a generation of people, they're about 15 years older than me, they're in their early to mid 50s, and they expect, because they've done what they've been told to do. They've worked, they've toiled, they've saved, they've invested. They expect to be taken care of in their senior years. They're not going to be. What's going to happen?
Well, it's not the case that they're not going to be. That if you look at, let's say we have a couple in the UK or the G7 who has saved the equivalent of, let's say, £500,000, and that's expressed in insurance policies and pension funds of various kinds, and personal savings that they have down at the bank. And what, if you look at that £500,000, if we hadn't had an enormous currency debasement globally, which was part of this, the purchasing power would be 3 or 4 or 5 times more than it is. So their first great loss has been through debasement. Now, they still have, you know, £500,000. It just buys a lot less. So the first thing has been playing the purchasing power with the inflation game. So that's number one. But number two, if you look at the services they depend on, those have also been debased. So they're paying taxes to government, and what they're getting for that is they're getting a lot less. And in fact, they're getting a government that in many ways is using that money against their best interest. So that's number two. Number three, if you look at what they're getting right now on interest at the bank. You know, in 1980, they were getting 8% on their deposits. Now, risk-free, they're getting almost nothing. And so when you're earning 8% on £500,000, you have quite a nice life. If you're earning 0% on £500,000, you're having to liquidate your £500,000 to get going. All of those things are not in the future. All of those things are not abrogation of any contract. All of those things are basically stealing their money in very invisible and subtle ways that they may not understand, you know, the way I understand them, but intuitively they know something is not right. Okay? So then the question becomes, will their pension funds abrogate the contracts? And that's where you get into, let's say they're depending on their pension funds to pay them £2,000 a month. And in fact, if you look at the pension fund, its earnings are going down, its yields are going down. It's a giant subsidy into the government. And in fact, more and more pension funds don't have the resources to maintain the contracts they've made. In the United States, a lot of them have the money they've or the ability to meet the commitments in dollar terms. They don't have the ability to fund the health care that they promised. So there's definitely a deficit. And when you look at that deficit, Richie, the question is the question I've been asking for 20 years. Where is the money? For example, right, you have now disappeared from U.S. government accounts. I was part of a group of people in the first Bush administration who got laws passed requiring audited financial statements. The process began in 1995, whereby the U.S. government confessed that they were not publishing audited financial statements as required by law. So we've run since 1995. The government in violation of the Constitution, in violation of the financial management laws, multiple financial management laws. But we know that $21 trillion of undocumentable adjustments have now taken place that we can document. I'm sure there are more. So let's just use round figures. $20 trillion missing from the federal government, it went someplace, okay? And that someplace has assets, and that someplace is liable. And in theory, we can get it back if enough people say, I want the money back. And one of the reasons the campaign is so tense in the United States right now is you will have running for president one of the people who is the real leader in disappearing that $20 trillion. And so there are a lot of people worried about their pension funds and worried about Social Security and saying, you know, why should we put back into the Oval Office someone who is clearly complicit in $20 trillion missing? But to me, I want more than that. I want to know, where is the $20 trillion and how do we get it back? Because you can get it back.
And you've spoken at length about this. You believe that money was put into what we call the black budget. That money was spent, not ironically, right, but chillingly. And it doesn't get any more malevolent. The money belonging to people was actually spent and used against people in these weapons programs and other programs, right?
Here are the options. I think some of that money was spent to fund governmental purposes that no one wanted to explain to the legislature. So I think some of it was spent on governmental purposes. I think a lot of it probably went down the black budget to do invisible projects, to build global empire, underground facilities, secret space programs, all of that. But I also believe that some of it went into what I would call an endowment. So there's $50 trillion missing between the bailouts and the missing money in the United States alone. That's before we look at Europe. $50 trillion, if you could earn 5% a year on it, is $2.5 trillion a year of dividends and interest that you could use to run a global government. So I think some of it has gone into an endowment that will allow the governmental structures. As I said, it's privatization at the root. You load the existing, you know you want to create a new governance structure for planet Earth. You suck the assets into the new, you push the liabilities into the old, and your new rises. So I think part of this was endowing a very private global governance structure.
This is a friend of mine listening to the program in Ireland has just said, and I think she's right, this is breathtakingly evil, isn't it? I mean, this is beyond the pale.
Okay, so let me say a couple things on behalf of the people who are involved in this. I don't know what the truth is, Richie. I really don't. And it's funny, whenever I do a show and say that, I'll get comments saying, well, she worked at the top of Washington Wall Street, so you know she's lying when she says she doesn't know. But you'd be amazed how many people in the system really... You know, everybody's on a need-to-know basis.
Compartmentalization, we call it. That's right. Absolutely. I believe you, by the way.
Right. I did work with people who I think probably knew. But if you dive into the black budget, when it first started. You know, we had the 47 Act and 49 Act in the United States, and it created the formal black budget, and we had the seizure of the monies in World War II that created, in combination, a hidden system of finance. And unfortunately, President Eisenhower authorized the CIA to do security for Area 51, and between that and the executive orders, the hidden budget, and then in the first Bush administration, executive orders made all that money available to pay corporations to own and manage the most powerful technology in the world. And so what happened is you created this infrastructure of private investors and corporations who had control of an infinite amount of money through the federal credit mechanism. They kind of got their teeth in it. Now, if you look at the people who engineered all of that from 47 to 1980, what you hear them always say was, well, it was the best of a lot of bad options. And so you have to ask the question, what are they dealing with? Why is it that they think there is such a great need for so much money? Now, I don't know the answer, but I know that there are enough people involved in the building of the black budget. They were not bad people. And I think you got to be very, very careful before you say, oh, this is happening because they're bad and I'm good. That leads you to places that doesn't help you understand what's really going on. And the more I've studied, the more I've looked at the black budget, the more I find that it's a complex phenomenon. Now, what is happening, which is bad, 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 if we want something that's just bad, 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 the leadership has made a decision that the general population is too stupid to know the truth and can't be trusted to act responsibly. I think that's a terrible mistake. Terrible mistake, because what you need is you need the human intelligence working on our problems and dealing with our problems, whatever they are. And so I would also, if you look at the secrecy has created enormous privilege. That privilege has created terrible behavior and terrible attitudes. And we now have a cycle of disrespect between the general population and the leadership. And unfortunately, my experience is the leadership has literally become a culture that is so perverted and so unhealthy that to me, you have to let go of that secrecy and privilege, or we're never going to get to some place. You know, we're never going to get back to civilization, which is where we need to go. And whether it's the mind control being used on the general population or the perversion of the elites, we are now cycling in the United States into a place where society is basically losing its mind. And if we're going to solve our problems, we've got to get our mind back.
All roads lead to depopulation of the planet, right? That when you began to realize that and process that, that couldn't have been easy for you, Catherine.
Well, it was really interesting. In 1998, I was trained as a portfolio strategist, and I've always looked at money at a very high level globally, because when you are doing portfolio strategy, you know, on one side of the balance sheet, you're competing globally with all the money in the planet for all the money in the planet. So you tend to look at everything at a very high level. And when you started to add up all the, I was in the middle of litigation with the federal government, and things really did seem to be going insane. And we were off and running on a global debt bubble that clearly could go to no place good. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And I couldn't come up with an explanation of the things that were happening, other than that we were going to depopulate down to about a half a billion to a billion people. And a portfolio strategist from London, who I worked with for a while, called me up and wanted to meet me. This is when we started to work together. So he came over to Union Station. He was also trained to look at things at a very high level. And there we were in 1998, eating lunch, beautiful sunny day. And he said to me in a very low voice, Stuart, he says, I know this sounds crazy, but if you look at this and this and this and this, he's naming all these different areas. He said, the only logical conclusion is they're planning on depopulating down to about a half a million people. And I said, that's my number. Now, that was 1998. If you look at what's been going on more recently, I have heard interviews of various people say, now that they're very satisfied with the mind control technology they've rolled out with the cell towers globally since 2001, pretty much, they don't feel the same pressure to depopulate. So, you know, and frankly, Richie, I'm more concerned about the mind control technology than I am about depopulation.
Which we could do a whole show on, and we've covered it at length here. In the time, because time is flying by, we've already done over a half an hour, and we've got about 10 minutes left on this. I've got to give your website details again, Catherine. It's Solari.com, folks. We've got the absolutely incredibly well briefed Catherine Austin Fitz on the program today. She's in Tennessee. This is vital stuff. This. Where does what's happening in Syria fit in with this? Because you said on a program recently that you're more concerned about a thermonuclear war than you are about a global financial crash. So, therefore, I concluded from that you're very, very concerned about an imminent Third World War. Now, you already mentioned Hillary Clinton and why so many American men and women with money saved and invested are worried about her. Should we be equally as worried, as a lot of commentators are saying, about her ascending to the Oval Office and what that might mean in the Middle East?
Well, Jack Ma, the head of Alibaba, said recently, war starts when trade stops. And when you issue this much debt, more debt than we have capacity to service, you start to create the pressures for war, particularly where there's global slowdown, which is what is happening now. So I've always been a lot more concerned about war than I have been about economic slowdown or collapse, but there's a relationship between the two. I think there are two things going on related to Syria. First, with respect to Russia, we have managed the global economy, Richie, on what I call the central banking warfare model for 500 years. The central banks print money, and then the military make sure everybody takes that money in exchange for cheap natural resources. And that all worked very well. We in the G7 lived a nice life as long as we could run around and exploit the emerging markets. Now, when you're globalizing, that subsidy flow has to change, and the political relationships have to change. And the question is, what's the new model? Now, clearly, the people who engineered the financial coup d'etat have a model. The Russians don't like their model because the Russians are interested in sovereignty. What happened to the Russians when the Americans came in? You know, basically, you had the U.S. intelligence agencies team up with the Russian mafia and take the place down. They never took it down completely because they were worried about the nuclear stockpiles getting into the wrong hands. And so along comes Putin, is able to build it back. But you have the Russians saying, no, we don't want to be chipped. We don't want to eat GMO food. We don't want to lose our individual and national sovereignty. A lot of it comes down to sacred values because our culture is quite perverted. And the Russians are saying, no, we have a long-term affinity for the Orthodox Church. We have sacred values. You know, there's a real battle of models. And then globally, within the United States, there are battles of model. Not everybody wants to be chipped and walk around in the fog. So we're having a global debate about models, and the people pushing the zero sovereignty transhumanism model are very forceful and have very invasive technology. And the general population is getting madder and madder. So we have the war of models. And until you sort out what the model's going to be, it can get very dicey. And that includes war with Russia. But there's something else going on. And that is one of the theories as to why the U.S. basically wasted a great deal of money and killed a lot of innocent people in the Middle East was to stay the hegemon along the Silk Road and to maintain the unipolar model. That may be partially, all right, I believe it's partially true. My question also is what's going on underground in the Middle East, because and that gets to the question of exopolitics and, you know, are we dealing with other civilizations and is that in play? I don't know the answer to that. But if you look at the effort that the U.S. made to get into the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, to this day, I'm not satisfied. It's just the Eurasia unipolar model. But now that we're in it, we're up to our eyeballs in terrible mess. And I don't know if you've been watching what's happening with Assange and WikiLeaks, but an enormous effort is being made to prevent the truth from coming out, or some of the most important truth. My guess is that WikiLeaks has the emails to document that the, you know, Libya, that once we were in Libya, we were rounding up all the weapons and then laundering them into ISIS. So, but we'll have to see what they come out with. I hope they finally make it out.
I'm fascinated by WikiLeaks personally, because I have a little bit of sympathy with something that John Rappaport has said several times on programs with me, and that is that Snowden and Assange and people like them, that really, when you weigh up what it is they've told us over the years, Catherine, it's never been anything really groundbreaking. It's all been stuff that we kind of knew anyway. You know, I sometimes read WikiLeaks and I think, where are the bodies? You understand, where's the real meat on the bones? I'm not saying now that I believe that they are part of any covert government program, but I'm not certain that they've ever really shaken our world with the revelations. But I want to just go back to Syria. I mean, we heard today any number of commentators saying that, you know, the escalation, well, not the escalation, but the offensive in Mosul in Iraq, the Iraqi and Kurdish forces to try and take back Mosul, is going to send more jihadists into Europe. Now, my contention is, and always has been, that the migrant crisis is twofold in its aims. Aim number one, it divides and conquers in Europe. It turns people against one another. It turns people very right-wing and very hateful, because services come under pressure. The health service comes under pressure. Any, you know, vital service comes under pressure when you, you know, bring a lot of people into a country. But at the same time, it does allow lunatic jihadists to cross borders into Europe. Is this part of their plan to keep us fighting one another and hating one another, Catherine, and not focusing on what it is they're doing themselves?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You keep the field in chaos, and you keep the field from building a shared intelligence and growing powerful. You churn it. I was, one of my greatest moments on the Saleri Report, which I published, was an interview with Dr. William Tiller, who had been head of material sciences at Stanford and had raised private funding to prove that that it was possible for human intention to change material reality, including at great distances. And so I said to him, Dr. Tiller, I'm very interested in community prayer. I'm dying to know what you think of it. And he said, well, you have to be very careful. If the people doing the praying are coherent, it can help. But if they're incoherent, it makes matters worse. So if you keep the general population in a state of confusion and incoherence, then they don't become powerful enough to start to invent their own future, and you can invent their future for them.
Let me ask you this. We're just about to run out of time. Thanks for your time today. It's been terrific to catch up with you finally, having heard you on so many shows stateside, across the pond, as it were. When our listeners hear people like you, because you're measured and calm and thoughtful in your approach, thankfully they don't panic, and that's important. But they do want to know, what should they do with their money, Catherine? This is a ridiculous thing to ask you and to say, oh, Catherine, we've only got 3 minutes now. What do we do with our bloody money? But that's what people are saying. What do we do? Should we take it out? Should we hoard cash? Should we buy silver, gold? It's maybe an unfair question to ask you, but I'm going to put you on the spot. How do you answer that? Because I have no answer, because I'm not qualified to answer it.
Well, there's a ton of things you can do, and you're right. It's very difficult to say it quickly, let alone, you know, everybody's different. So it's very different people or different situations. I just did an interview on Gaia University, and I put up 10 steps of things you can do, including financial. And what I'll do, Richie, after I hang up, I'll make it public so that I have it just for subscribers, but I'll make it public. So you can go to Saleri.com, and it'll give you a couple links and other things you can do. Before we close, I would like to add, I've been listening to the Richie Allen Show for quite some time and occasionally posting some of your shows up on our website for our subscribers. And I will say this, remember when I said that they're just some people who seem to stay grounded and see reality, and they don't get rocked and they don't fall for the tricks. You've always struck me as being that kind of person. So before we close, I'd like to ask you how you do it, because I keep trying to teach people how to be more like you. And so maybe you know.
Do you know what I do, Catherine? I switch completely off it at weekends, and I spend time with the woman I love and our dog, and we go out and we spend time in nature, and we just don't think about it, and we stay away from it, and we only return to it on Monday morning. That might be a stupid answer, but that, it might not sound you know, like a good answer. But first of all, thanks for saying that. But that's what I do. I do disconnect from it. And when I put the podcast online shortly, and I advertise that on social media, and I give you a write-up and tell people what you spoke about, I won't think about it again till tomorrow. I really won't. And it's difficult for some people, but I feel if you don't do that, it's going to become very... It's going to affect you and it's going to hurt you. That's what I believe.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Go hug a tree. That's the answer.
I know. It sounds very glib, doesn't it? But it is what I do. You know, today I was out in pouring rain with my dog in a country lane. And even though it was pouring with rain, I could hear birds. And the dog was running around loving herself in the absolute downpour that it was. And I just looked around and I went, we're going to win in the end. You know, this is beautiful.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, we could talk about this for another show, but we're absolutely going to win. Speaking of which, I just want to point out that the movie on the Solari Report this week we do, Let's Go to the Movies Every Week, is a documentary called Dark Horse. Have you seen it?
I haven't, but I'm going to watch it.
You got to watch it, because it gets right to the heart of the point about why we're going to win. So it's about ordinary people doing extraordinary things. You need to watch it, okay?
I'll tweet it, of course, and I'll retweet your website where people can find you. And thanks for... spreading our program around and giving it to people who wouldn't ordinarily get it, Catherine, because you've got obviously a very, very high profile. And I'm not kissing your behind in saying that. You do have a very high profile because of where you've been and what you've done. Let's, with your permission, let's not leave it too long before you come back on again. And if you fancied it, we could do something this side of Christmas where we could talk to people about what they can do with the wealth that they have available to them.
Absolutely. I would love to do it.
We'd be honoured. And thanks very much for coming back to us so quickly. And Claire is thrilled, our producer, that you came on. Folks, it's Solari.com. You don't get very many people in a lifetime like Catherine Austin Fitz, who've been in the corridors of power, who've worked with you know, good people and bad people, and who've seen it from the inside, and who has the courage to talk about it. Catherine, I've loved you coming on. Thanks for giving us your time. And let's book you in sometime in November. Let's get you on for a longer segment. And we'd be honoured to do that.
Have a great day, Richie.
You too. Wonderful stuff. Catherine Austin Fitz on the line to us there from her home in Tennessee, from her office in Tennessee. And you can find her at Solari, that's Solari.com. I'm going to take a very quick break. When I come back, I'm probably going to have to wrap up because time is running out.
Do you want to release the full potential of your soul consciousness and find out how to experience that power in all areas of your life now? Go to livingasyoursoul.com for free guidance with in-depth how-to articles, free healing meditations of creation recordings, free soul solutions, and much, much more. livingasyoursoul.com, making the profound practical.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Right, you're welcome back to the programme. That's kind of it for the show for Tuesday, October 18th. Catherine has sent me the video which I'm going to, the trailer for Dark Horse, which is on Solari, I believe. I'm going to tweet that out before I close out the program, or before I pack up for the day. I do that, you know, and I did mention this on the program before. We get tweeted by people and emailed by people quite a lot. We get a lot of correspondence because we've been around for a couple of years and we've grown a very substantial audience, so people get in touch with us. It's true to say that the vast majority of people who get in touch with us are not responded to. And the reason they're not responded to is because, apart from Claire producing the programme with me, which she does brilliantly, there's nobody monitoring or handling the correspondence that comes into the programme, because we just don't have anybody to do that. And I can't do it. I just can't do it. If I was to answer the emails that come into the programme every day, I'd never get on air. I'd never research what I need to research. I'd never edit the monologue. I'd never do all the other things that I need to do around the programme. So a lot of things come into the programme and we don't always get to respond to them. It's not because we're ignorant bastards whom are up our own arses, you know, that, you know, we think we're important. No, we're not. But we just can't do it. But I'll tell you, I do observe from time to time that people email us and they're not doing well. They're not doing well with the information. And this is something I've spoken with David Icke about privately many, many times. You know, it really affects people. It hurts people. The levels of evil and the levels of criminality in the world. And when I do speak to people, and every now and then I'll meet somebody in Manchester, once in a blue moon I'll be in a shop and somebody will recognise my bloody accent and, oh, you're Richie, Fab Radio 2, Richie, you do the conspiracy show. Yeah, yeah. And then they'll talk to me and say, you know, it really gets me. And I say, break away from it. I got criticised recently for not answering when I'm tagged on Facebook. And I got back to that person and said, I don't give a shit about Facebook. Certainly not at the end of a week when we've worked hard on making this programme. By the end of the week, I don't want to know about it. I want to spend time with the people I love. My partner. Our friends who come and see us sometimes at weekends and spend time with us and share a bottle of wine with us. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to think about it. I don't want to listen to it. I don't want to have anything to do with it until the following week. Because I tell you something. If you don't stop and spend a bit of time appreciating what's good in your life, you'll forget what it is you're actually fighting for. You'll actually wonder, what the hell am I fighting for? Now, I'm not fighting for anything. I interview people who are doing all the fighting. That's all I'm going to say on that. Now, tomorrow, Aaron Callan's mother's funeral takes place just outside Bury in the early afternoon. I'm attending it because Aaron is obviously a very close friend of mine. I didn't know his mother, sadly. But I love Aaron and he's been a huge part of the programme and I'm attending it. Now, David Icke and the David Icke team are in Italy. And David is very fond of Aaron as well because Aaron does some work for David and davidicke.com. So I'll be representing myself and David and Linda and Jamie and Gareth tomorrow. So there won't be a programme tomorrow night because after his mum is laid to rest, there's going to be a remembrance for her and some food and I've been invited to that and I'm going to go to spend some time with Aaron. So I won't be here tomorrow, Wednesday. There will be a repeat programme on instead of me. However, we will be live as always on Thursday at 8 p.m. BST and there will be an extended lunchtime programme on Friday. So I'm not missing any programmes this week. But tomorrow I won't be on air because I'm going to pay my respects to Aaron and to Vicky and their children and his family. Thanks to Claire for a brilliant programme. Great production, Claire. To Simon, to Aaron himself for the website work. To my friend Jean-Ann for all the encouragement in the capital. And to you for listening. Thanks for listening to the programme. Look after yourselves and one another. And I'll see you, of course, on Thursday at 8 p.m. BST with another programme. See you soon. Bye for now. Thank you. Thanks to my guests, by the way. Really enjoyed them as well.
We have all the time in the world. Time enough for life to unfold.
precious things love has in store. We have all